Good morning, everybody. I am Ian Williams from the Foreign Press Association here in New York in the heat wave. Not as hot as the South China Sea politically, I'm pleased to say. And we have with us in a very timely way, Vincent Wei Jingjiang, who is sort of appeared on the cusp of the moment because obviously Speaker Pelosi did not share her schedule with us and or with anybody else, come to think of it. So we had to arrange this in an impromptu way, very late. And Vincent was rose to the occasion when we called and asked. He's often spoken about the issue of Taiwan and the US and the PRC. Is at the cusp of it. He is with the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's written about Taiwan. And he's the Dean of Politics, I believe it is, at Adelphi University, as I believe it's pronounced. And we want to discuss the implications, because although Pelosi has now left Taiwan, the ripples will be spreading across the Pacific. The PRC is conducting alleged live fire exercises around Taiwan. And I mean, if I were Nancy Pelosi and the president of Taiwan, I'd be very pleased that we've managed to ruffle the scales of the Chinese dragon to such an extent, since instead of keeping a stiff upper lip and acting calm, they have really run round like squawking chickens about this, but haven't so far done anything effective. I really don't believe that Taiwan is going to be terminally harmed by a ban on the import of frozen mackerel from Taiwan, for example, which is one of the least significant measures that the PRC has announced. And that suggests that they're looking for something. They have to show something. So, Vincent, we're looking at this, at the geopolitics. It seems there are no good options in this, are there? I mean, you have an immovable object in the sense of the PRC, but an unstoppable momentum from Taiwan say, you know, we're not going to bow down to the PRC's mode. And I was thinking as I was looking through the research from this, completely absent from Beijing's narrative on this is any hint that the people of Taiwan want them there. And I think that was significant. They don't even pretend this is some desire for reunification on the part of the exiled Han masses in Taiwan. Even they know that they couldn't get away with that idea. So how does this play into geopolitics? So Joe Biden doesn't look very good out of it because he temporized. Pelosi looks good, but she's not running for election. And President Xi is upset, but doesn't really look very good out of it because he hasn't been able to do anything. So was this a creative move? Did it add to the sum of human happiness? Or was it a detraction?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Williams and Foreign Press Association for inviting me to speak to you today. I mean, I'm more like an informal exchange of ideas. I appreciate FPA's interest in something high politics 7,000 miles away. I think that what happened in the Taiwan Strait exemplified by Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, or arguably controversial, is actually a prelude to what things to come. The reason I say this is that we can probably read some tea leaves from the evolving relationship among China, the US, and Taiwan. I think and many elements compare the controversy caused by speakers the visit this time in 2022 with the last time a U.S. speaker visited Taiwan, which was 1997 by Newt Gingrich, a Republican at that time, vis-a-vis a Democratic president, Bill Clinton. I think the big difference, of course, is that in 25 years, China has become more powerful, more assertive, and really thinks that it has a solution to the so-called Taiwan issue. And the in the 25 years, Taiwanese, you ask, you know, absent from this narrative is how Taiwanese think about this issue. You're correct that the Chinese government completely neglect to even ask whether their proposals for Taiwan, such as one country, two systems, and so on, is of any appeal. I mean, empirically, the Taiwanese have shown through successive opinion polls that there has been a very notable change in how they identify themselves, the national identification, that, you know, in 1992, more than 50% of the Taiwanese think they are both Taiwanese and Chinese. And there's also sizable people think they are Chinese. But fast forward to today, that only about 2 or 3% of Taiwanese think they are Chinese. And over 60% think they are Taiwanese exclusively. And the balance is actually the dual identity. So what this means is that there has been a very silent but significant psychological shift about how Taiwanese think about China and think about their future, if any, with China. Now, I said, you know, the Taiwanese, of course, in the last 25 years have also lived under constant and, in fact, increasing pressure and threat from China. But they also know that the Chinese have vowed that they will crush Taiwan independence with force and so on. So they live in a very uneasy existence. And their attitude toward Speaker Pelosi's visit is summed up by an expression called quiet defiance. So they don't make trouble, they don't provoke the dragon in the eye, but they are nonetheless very defiant. They are very resilient. They are absolutely not interested in Beijing's design for them. And of course, their very existence and their international personhood have been threatened by China on a daily basis. So that's why they reach out to Pelosi's visit with such open arm, you know, to them, that they need this kind of a symbolic support. Some people will say that this is purely symbolic and it has no strategic objective and so on. And in the end, it will harm Taiwan more than it will really help Taiwan. But I think that in diplomacy, sometimes symbolism has its role. I think in this regard, that Taiwan has a very rare diplomatic coup, and this counts as one. And having a the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives to so publicly come out to Taiwan to support the democracy, especially in the face of Chinese fierce opposition, is a very important statement. Now that what needs to follow is that the United States and Taiwan and other like-minded democracies in the Indo-Pacific region need to work together to cope with a China that is increasingly powerful and more likely to use force to accomplish its goals.
I mean, one of the parallels here would be Vladimir Putin went into Ukraine and seemed to be suffering from the delusion that the Ukrainians were waiting for reunification with their Slavic brothers in Russia, and that everything would collapse, that they'd be welcomed with open arms as this Russian army denazified it. You don't suspect that the people in Beijing have any such delusions, do you?
Well, no, I think the people in Beijing have, you know, they denounce the very existence of Taiwan. And so to them, the future of Taiwan is foregone conclusion. And that in the past, that they their capabilities are not there. But now they have calculated that in order to incorporate Taiwan in this sort of national this dream of national reunification, that they need to also take into account the possibility of U.S. intervention. But of course, the situation is dynamic. There's no such thing as a status quo that is static. And the status quo has actually evolved over time. That is that we acknowledge that the Chinese have become more powerful, more proficient, and more assertive, but the Taiwanese and the Americans are not standing still. They are also quietly upgrading their capability. And of course, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which often draws comparison with Taiwan, the China-Taiwan relations, also accelerated the urgency of this preparation.
And another parallel situation is, of course, Hong Kong, where you could say the nail in the coffin for Taiwanese thoughts of some type of reunification was the Chinese complete disregard for their agreement. And I wonder, I haven't heard in the discourse from Taiwan or from the US to the Chinese, excuse me, you're trying to hold us to promises made 50 years ago at the UN. How about you hold down to your promises in Hong Kong?
Yes. Yes, I think the very regrettable, I would even say the tragic denouement of Hong Kong is a warning sign to Taiwan. Taiwan has always been sort of skeptical and careful about China's quote-unquote promise to Hong Kong. But of course, the Xi Jinping government decided to take over, to cramp down on all these potential opposition. His talk in 2019 about equating one country, two systems, which is basically a design for Hong Kong and Taiwan, with the so-called One China principle, China's One China principle. And then under this One China principle, Taiwan is reduced to only talking about a Taiwan formula. I think that talk basically killed any hope of any reputable political party in Taiwan to even nominally acknowledge a One China concept. So many political scientists have analyzed that Xi was actually the biggest campaigner for Tsai Ing-wen's re-election in 2020, because prior to that, the Democratic Progressive Party was floundering in the midterm election in 2018, but then extradition demonstration in Hong Kong and China's crackdown and Xi's reinterpretation of a very restrictive definition of one country, two systems, basically gave the DPP a propaganda coup that you cannot trust the Chinese, and the Taiwanese voters actually believe them. And I think that there's a lot of credence, to show skepticism or disbelief or uninterest in a one country, two systems.
Inside Taiwan itself, since we almost alone seem to be talking about Taiwanese public opinion, the Kuomintang has really seems to have suffered from its and reconsidered from its previous alignment with the mainland. And I understand they've recently opened a liaison office in Washington.
Yes.
They're reconsidering in several ways. Do you think, how is this going to play on the Kuomintang approach to things?
Yeah. When the last time when Kuomintang held the presidency was in 2008 to 2016, Ma Ying-jeou, the basic policy was a pro-US peace with China and friendly toward Japan. It was a very careful diplomatic balance, if you will, and the cross-strait relations entered a period of détente, which was all fine. But at that time, it was because China could actually live with the KMT's version of the One China, which is One China, each side with its own interpretation. And the Kuomintang would say that One China is the Republic of China, because KMT claims to be the successor of the ROC. And the PRC basically would not openly deny it. So this was sort of a very careful coexistence for 8 years. But now that the after the DPP came to power, they don't agree that there ever was a so-called 1992 consensus, sort of agreement to disagree, and that the CCP has accused the DPP for being the originator of all the trouble, and they have actually tightened and restricted the room for respective interpretation. Now there is no respective interpretation, one China according to Xi Jinping. And this has actually drastically reduced and completely shut out any room for, as I said earlier, any reputable political party, even the opposition party, KMT, to embrace an openly a pro-China stance, because that would be politically suicidal in Taiwan's domestic politics. So what we see is that all the major parties in Taiwan now find that as the U.S.-China relationship continue to deteriorate, they have no choice but to side with the U.S. even more.
Now, Kieran McGrath from The Express is asking, is Taiwan prepared for the arrival of more senior figures from the U.S. and elsewhere? Because with election season coming, I can imagine vote-hunting politicians dropping in and prepared, regardless of the consequences for Taiwan and the South China Sea, of coming and grandstanding in Taipei. Is that a possibility?
I think somewhat a similar line of thinking pertain to Speaker Pelosi. Some say that, you know, she was... she probably anticipate that the ruling party, the Democratic Party, would not do so well in the upcoming midterm election in November, and that historically the ruling party generally lose seats, and they will probably lose the majority of the House. Therefore, the Speaker will become the former Speaker. So this is like a graduation trip and that kind of thing, and that you know, it's also possible that some politicians might eye some you know, tangible benefits from these trips, disregarding larger national interests in light of geopolitics. I think that the I want to draw your members' attention to a piece of legislation in 2018 enacted by U.S. Congress. It's called the Taiwan Travel Act, and this act basically seeks to gradually redress many of the self-imposed restrictions on travels by U.S. Officials from the executive or the legislative branches over the years, and that it's intended to conduct a more normal relationship with the people of Taiwan. And, you know, that the in theory, that then, you know, that there should be no restriction of senior level officials from Taiwan, from the U.S. to visit Taiwan. But in reality, we know that every time that a senior official from the U.S. visit, China would react very negatively. This includes the U.S. Health Secretary, Alex Azar, and also the number three person in the State Department, and of course now the Speaker Pelosi. So in the future, there could be other higher ranking U.S. officials visiting Taiwan, but I hope that that's, you know, to conduct really substantive issues to strengthen the economic partnership, security, cooperation, and so on. And one thing we did not hear very openly is whether the Taiwanese have also expressed their own sense of the assessment of the situation, whether the cons actually outweigh the pros in a particular time. So I think there will be some quiet discussions below the surface.
There's a lot of nuance here between standing against Chinese bullying, you might say, and not needlessly provoking, because you've got a world audience watching. You know, nobody wants nobody wants you tweaking the dragon's scales unnecessarily.
Right. No, I think if high level visits to establish personal relationship, to understand each other's viewpoints, is absolutely necessary for strengthening U.S.-Taiwan relation partnership. But it doesn't have to be that every trip is actually a poke in the eye of the dragon. You know, so some visit can be public, some visit can be private. I mean, not so public.
Yeah, but it's how the Chinese would react to it that really makes it here. There's an old poem by Rudyard Kipling, that great imperialist, about paying the Danegeld. The Vikings used to raid Britain every year and loot the monasteries, rape and pillage, and they had the bright idea of giving them money to go away. And the Vikings thought, what a good idea, let's come back next year, guaranteed income. So there's this idea that by deferring to people like the PRC, you're actually encouraging them to come back for more.
Yeah, and then it becomes newsworthy for the benefit of this organization.
Well, that's what we're here for. We have another from Poonam Sharma, who is looking at the 20th Chinese Party Congress in October. And I'm sorry, I'm not sure whether Poonam is he or she, you have to forgive me. There have been signals that show Xi's political opponents have continued to challenge the succession of Xi to a third term. The biggest challenge has been from opposition factions within the CCP, where he's seen as outwardly strong and inwardly weak. And do you feel that China's rhetoric over Pelosi's visit was in part an attempt by Xi to present an image of strength and bolster his chances? We discussed this earlier about how, in the absence of any ideology for the Communist Party, nationalism and posturing about it has been the big vote winner within the party circles. So how would you assess this? Is the 20th Congress important on the gesture politics here?
I think it does play a role, probably plays a very, a very important role. I think everybody now knows that Xi Jinping is interested in being anointed for an unprecedented third term. And his main pretext is that he's a strong leader who will accomplish the so-called national rejuvenation of China, which actually includes the recovery of Taiwan. So this is basically because there's no election, so this is basically his campaign platform, right? And then, of course, this is amidst a very challenging domestic environment. The China's economic growth, which was another pillar for the CCP's rule for the last 30 or 40 years, is slowing. Is slowing down, and the so-called zero COVID policy has caused a lot of resentment and also slowed down the economy. And of course, that Xi Jinping is not without some internal challenges, that, you know, the usual power struggle or factional struggle within the CCP, which is very difficult, very opaque to the outsiders. So all this is to say that Xi's becoming the leader, undisputed leader for a third term at the 20th Congress, is not yet a foregone conclusion. You know, there could still be some uncertainties. This is why Xi has found that it's very important to project him as an image of a very strong leader who can, quote unquote, stand up to the superpower, the United States. Now, there's a difference between standing up to the ego and trying to do something foolish against the ego. I think that will probably give us clues on how the Chinese are going to stand down from the military exercises and so on, because the Chinese also know very well that handling the relationship with the United States is absolutely crucial. You want to be, appear tough and to be equal to the United States, but you cannot afford a premature military showdown with the U.S. military because, number one, the Chinese military is not ready. Number two, if there should be a military confrontation with the U.S. Military, the Chinese there's no certainty that China can win at this moment. Probably it will be defeated. So that will be disastrous. That will be disastrous for Xi. So Xi needs this nationalism to play up just to the right degree, you know, and not too hot, not too cold, just about right.
Goldilocks. Yeah. But what is the Goldilocks version here? Because one of the factors in here, because the world has never been quite so interconnected with Kosovo, Transnistria, rumblings across the globe, but in particular with Ukraine. To what extent do you think the abysmal performance of the Russian army has played into the PLA's assessment of what their chances were and therefore dialed down the chance of a conflict?
Yes. I have no doubt that the Chinese, the Americans, and the Taiwanese are looking at the Russian-Ukraine situation very intently. I think what matters more is what kind of lessons they draw. I think that from the Chinese standpoint, they probably will derive some comfort as well as some discomfort from the lessons in Ukraine. They might be very pleased to see that the Western world, the NATO and the United States and so on, has vowed to support Ukraine through other means, such as providing munitions or providing training and even volunteers, but absolutely no direct military involvement. So they could probably draw lesson number one, that if they invade Taiwan, the United States probably will not get involved militarily, which after all is the decisive factor. And the U.S. stated policy is strategic ambiguity. So the United States also say that we are not going to say in advance whether we will get involved militarily. It all depends. And hopefully by keeping it ambiguous, we will keep everybody in check. You know, Beijing from using force, Taipei from doing something reckless. Now, the Beijing can also probably draw a lesson that the Western response is mainly a series of economic sanctions. You know, it's a net, but it's not a tight net. There are some loopholes, and China's economy is much more integrated with the world and much larger than Russia. So the upshot is that China can withstand the economic sanctions if the Western world will impose the same kind of or even strong, and the Western world probably even be more reluctant to impose sanctions against China because they will not do so without hurting themselves. So this is how the Chinese might think. But the Chinese might also find it dispiriting that if a land invasion is so hard, because after all, Russia and Ukraine share long land borders, and the once almighty Soviet army performed, to use your word, Ian, abysmally in Ukraine, then trying to accomplish Taiwan, which is an island, the only way you can actually conquer Taiwan is actually through an amphibious assault, which is not an easy task by any stretch of the imagination. And that, that is the PLA actually ready? You know, would that give the outside world, particularly the United States, some time to think, to regroup, and so on? So I think in the end, the lessons are really mixed, and they are, they also need to see whether there will be a political settlement from the Ukraine-Russia situation to conclude whether, in the case of Taiwan, conquest will pay.
One of the issues that did come up, and it's an undercurrent all the way, is one of Russia's big problems is lack of semiconductors.
Mm-hmm.
It's not steel and guns. It's silicon chips that, right. You know, they have a lot of weapons which are pretty dumb weapons at the moment.
Yes.
Because the bits that make them work are, well, amongst other things, mostly made in Taiwan. And this is a double-edged threat because people in Washington were wondering whether, you know, can the U.S. It gives, how should we say, an ace to Taiwan, and the U.S. didn't let the world's biggest semiconductor manufacturer go under enemy control. So how does the chip politics play into it?
Yes. And this notion about the silicon shield was once floated as an idea of sort of an additional layer of Taiwan's security, or at least Taiwan's integration with the world economy. I think during the pandemic, that everybody feel the pain, so to speak, because of the shortage of semiconductors, all kinds, you know, from cars to computers to weapons and so on. And Taiwan is a world leader in semiconductors, has the world's most advanced foundry, pure foundry, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, TSMC, in Taiwan. So that's almost like a crown jewel that everybody wants to control. And from the US standpoint, it's obviously much better that it is in a friendly hand than, say, in the PRC hand. And then the PRC, might be, because the PRC now is denied of some critical technology, for example, in lithography and so on. So getting the TSMC or the semiconductor capabilities in Taiwan would be a sort of the icing on the cake for China to conquer Taiwan, you know, in addition to the national rejuvenation, because there's still going to be a significant economic prize. I think that this probably is an argument why it's very important for the industrial democracies, you know, to have a vested interest and an additional regard for the importance of Taiwan's semiconductor industry, high-tech industry in general, and to find ways to include Taiwan in a series of regional and bilateral economic partnership agreements. I always feel that a internationally isolated Taiwan is an insecure Taiwan. So that, of course, due to diplomatic decorum, many countries were leery about doing business with Taiwan, or at least not to risk the ire of China. If China is angry, then many countries will shy away. But let's not forget that Taiwan is a full-fledged member of the World Trade Organization. And the WTO charter says that every member has the right to enter into these preferential trade agreements with other members, which actually includes China. So I think that we need to encourage the more of Singapore's or New Zealand to and of course the United States or the United Kingdom to tie Taiwan more closely with these economic partnership, so that you often say that good economics also make good politics. That's a good way to actually strengthen the partnership,
which is what Senator Bernie Sanders is saying as well, because he opposed subsidies to American chip makers on the grounds there were subsidies to exporting American jobs abroad. And he pointed out the paucity of actual semiconductor manufacturing in the U.S. So,
And of course, now the Biden administration wants starting with the Trump administration, the Biden administration wants these U.S. Semiconductor manufacturers to come home, or at least to have these foreign major producers to set up plants in Arizona, Wisconsin, and elsewhere to produce American jobs.
Yes, maybe even in New York.
Right. Yeah. New York, the labor cost is very high.
Well, you need skilled workers as well.
Of course, it's a skilled worker, yes.
I mean, surely with the semiconductor manufacture, the amount of labor to skill is it makes the labor costs marginal. Yes, the sweep factory floor are cheap.
It's heavily capital intensive. Each modern factory will easily cost billions of US dollars.
So is Taiwan taking active measures to cement its future by investing in the United States with the manufacturing?
I mean, we have seen that, you know, the major players like TSMC has a major investment in Arizona, and Foxconn, which produced for Apple and so on, had a investment project in Wisconsin. I need to check the status of that. So I think the Taiwanese understand that this is a good way to cement relationship with the United States. But of course, these are private companies. The government cannot tell them what to do. It has to be economically beneficial for them to do so.
Yeah. But apart from all of this, there are a lot complex of international agreements that Taiwan is party to and China is party to. Mm-hmm. You just reminded me of the occasion when the first DPP president spoke by a remote link in New York. I was on the panel with my chum, not exactly comrade in arms, John Bolton. And I remember I caused a bit of a stare because I said, well, look, if you look at it, China is part of the NPT. If Taiwan is part of China, then Taiwan is totally entitled to nuclear weapons.
Yes.
Or it doesn't exist and it's not part of the NPT. So it's entirely entitled to nuclear weapons because it's not part of the agreement. It's never signed the agreement. So whichever way, you know, it makes a lot of sense for Taiwan to get itself a nuclear weapon, and they've got actual existential threats. I am anti-nuclear, by the way. So this was
I understand.
This was me being sort of playful and tweaking the dragon scales. But I understand it got some coverage. But we have the NPT conference in New York this week with the UN. And, you know, of course, all of the nuclear powers have flagrantly violated it in terms of transfer technologies. The US transferred technology to the US. Both of them are transferring it to Australia. The suspicions that China might have transferred it to Pakistan. And of course, the no first use one has been violated because the Russians have said they might use them first. All of them have violated the actual norms and they promised to neglect it. So where do you think this appears? How does Taiwan play into this? And can the world afford to neglect a potential nuclear power like Taiwan as in NPT negotiations?
Yes. So you're right, Ian, that this NPT, you know, the status of Taiwan has actually caused some legal, bizarre legal arguments, right, when it comes to NPT. On the one hand, Taiwan is not a signatory of NPT. Does that mean that it actually lies outside the purview of NPT and so on? But then on the other hand, that China, the PRC, which of course is a signatory of NPT, says that their promise of no first use is only applicable to other states because they don't recognize Taiwan as a state. So does that mean that they can actually use nuclear weapons against their own compatriots? Of course, you know that it's a question that the Chinese can answer. Now, as some of your members might know, that for a sophisticated industrial economy such as Taiwan, you know, which actually at this moment about 18% of its power is generated by nuclear power, it has you know, well-established nuclear engineering departments and so on. It's a matter of whether Taiwan wants to go down that path to cross the lubricant, so to speak, rather than whether Taiwan can or not. It's not a matter of can or it's whether. But of course, that's a political decision. So Taiwan was found to develop nuclear capabilities was in 1988. And all the government pronouncements after that have stuck with the so-called the three no policy. So Taiwan will not possess, will not produce, will not develop nuclear weapons. And Taiwan, and this is why the for non-nuclear states against nuclear states, the concept of extended deterrence becomes even more important, because where I say Japan and South Korea, you know, they're both nuclear capable, but they also renounced nuclear weapons. They depend on US nuclear umbrella. The US does not have a formal nuclear umbrella over Taiwan, because as a condition for recognizing the PRC in 1979, the United States also abrogated its mutual defense treaty with the ROC. So what the United States does have is a implicit security guarantee in the form of Taiwan Relations Act, which of course does not say, explicitly say that US will do what in case something happens. But I think that the nuclear dimension will come into play when, say, the Chinese use force against Taiwan and the United States get involved, and China now thinking like Russia, if the United States will quickly destroy its forces, including nuclear arsenal deployed around the coast and so on, then it will be better to first use the weapons before they are rendered useless. In other words, they are destroyed and so on. So that will be a scenario similar to the Russian discourse in Ukraine. I think that's why the United States and China should really be careful that anytime two nuclear power get involved, the possibility of escalation always exists. That's why even during the Cold War, there was no direct military clash between two nuclear powers. There were a series of proxy wars, so Afghanistan, Angola, etc. But there's no direct shootout between the Soviet Union and the United States, because anything could actually escalate. And we hope that this will not. And of course, China is not the Soviet Union in terms of the quality and the quantity, but China is very interested in achieving parity with the United States. So that logic still applies.
How does, on a broader scale as well, the failure of the US to support Taiwan would presume mean that it would precipitate a rush by Japan and South Korea? If the implicit guarantee goes missing, then they think we'll have to have an explicit guarantee and arm ourselves if we can't trust Washington.
Yeah, this is a very important point. Classical realists will say that, the Taiwan is not a core national interest of the United States. When comes to show that, the China cares more about Taiwan than the US cares about Taiwan. True to some extent, but sometimes superpowers also need to care a lot about the credibility of its security guarantees. And I think that if the United States does not intervene on behalf of Taiwan in the case of a unprovoked Chinese attack, then I think there will be tremendous pressure for other US allies, non-nuclear allies, such as Japan or the South Korea, to question the reliability of US security guarantee. And they may feel that this world that has become Chinese dominant, and they could no longer trust the U.S. and they will have to go nuclear as well. I think the possibility does exist. In fact, it's actually quite strong.
That comes back to Washington. Jim Potsangera says, what does the controversy the bipartisan backing Pelosi's received say about how Washington views China? We're coming up to the midterms now. And how does Pelosi's visit pay into this one? Now, we know that Donald Trump's least favorite politician after Joe Biden is Nancy Pelosi. I mean, he has a wax image of her in his bedroom. He sticks pins in every night. Rhetoric. So how does this play? I mean, because he has been totally and self-obsessedly ambivalent about Taiwan. He accuses other people of not standing up to China, but then kowtows to them more than anybody else when the time comes. So if he is a major player in the midterms and the next elections, how will Taiwan figure into that complex, do you think?
I think you mentioned Ambassador John Bolton. He wrote a memoir after his stint at the National Security Council. He described a scene where President Trump, former President Trump, used a pencil to describe the pencil tip is Taiwan and the paper is China and so on. So to him, the Trump as a businessman, this actually was a source of a lot of anxiety for my friends in Taiwan, that they think that they were concerned that Trump's support for Taiwan was instrumental, that could be traded and so on. So and in fact that we have to take Trump's comment on Pelosi this time with a little bit of grain of salt. After all, Pelosi did not care much about Trump either, and actually tore up his State of the Union speech in front of the president. So I think these two politicians did not get along well. Now, and we also know that Trump is in a way trying to make a political comeback, so to speak. But I think the Republican Party is having some kind of internal soul searching within itself. I mean, do they want to be? do they want to be known as the Trump's party or not? Whether Trump's very visible role will help them in the midterm election or not, and will actually another candidate be more suited for 2024?
Frank Gomez wants to know what will come of the two-hour meeting between Xi and Biden. Little has been reported about what was accomplished. Was that because there was little to report?
I think, from what I know from the readout and the news reports, they spent more than 2 hours on the phone call, and the majority was basically a respective enunciation of one's position on Taiwan. And of course, they are talking past each other. I mean, they're rehashing their well-known positions. I think that if there are some tangible outcomes from that talk, it was that after that talk, probably they help set down some guardrails for the continuing deteriorating bilateral relationship. And I think that Xi probably came to the conclusion that no matter how much he did not like that, Biden would not stop or could not stop Pelosi from visiting Taiwan, and that Biden probably learned from that talk that Xi was very, very unhappy about this, and that the U.S. Should make preparation and so on. I mean, if there's any tangible outcome from that talk, I think is their professed interest in continuing talking. And in diplomatic world, keep talking is better than not talking. And in fact, largely due to Xi's lack of overseas trip in the last 2 years due to COVID, that the fact that they say that they are interested in meeting on the sideline of the G20 summit in Indonesia in November is a positive sign. I think that when they do meet in person for the first time in many years, that's better than talking through Zoom.
You mentioned, we were talking about the lines in the sand and the gestures that were made. Well, do you think when Joe Biden says, for example, that there will be no troops on the ground in Ukraine, it's a sensible thing to think? Is it a sensible thing to say? Like, I mean, how would you interpret his, he obviously didn't factor in the Chinese response when he said that the military told him that Pelosi shouldn't go. Whether that's true or not, we don't know. But it strikes me as a very silly thing to say diplomatically, because you're putting your cards on the table before they're called.
Yeah, and we know that President Biden may be a old-style politician, very, what they call retail politician. He may be speaking his mind, but we also know that sometimes he's not very careful with words. And I agree with you that in that case, that he probably divulged too much information.
Or insufficient information, in a sense, depending on which way you're looking at it. It's you're leaving a hostage to fortune. And do you think that the people in Washington really understand Xi and the PRC leadership, how they think? I mean, obviously, the PRC people have difficulty in understanding a political system whereby an official like the speaker is independent of the president and can give a finger to the president if necessary for electoral purposes, which is sort of inconceivable almost in the Beijing concept. You know, any senior Chinese politician who performed a similar disrespect for Xi would end up with a bullet in his neck somewhere.
I think obviously the Chinese system is very opaque, and the degree of concentration of power in the hands of one ruler is not familiar to the Western world. So I think that, yes, in that regard, the West does not understand the Chinese political system well enough in general, and Xi Jinping in particular. But I do think that there is a growing consensus among the academic world and the policy world that Xi Jinping is a much more self-confident and assertive nationalistic leader, unseen from Mao era. And he is also more prone to risk-taking. I think his predecessor, Hu Jintao, was more risk-averse, colorless technocrat. And Jiang Zemin was busy of repairing China's reputation right after Tiananmen crackdown. But Xi Jinping has actually felt that China's time has come. And I've been studying Chinese politics for a while, and that I was actually amazed by how we are repeating the cycle. Namely, that every 10 years since the end of Cultural Revolution, that there will be a new leader produced internally and secretly in Zhongnanhai in Beijing, and that the West, the outside world, is reduced to make some very silly argument, such as that we can only hope that by concentrating more power in their hands, the new Chinese leader will embark on a political reform. And it turns out that every leader, Chinese leader, produced in this way has kept the pro, kept the creep, but not the quote. In other words, they kept the power, but they have never embarked on meaningful political reform or moderated their foreign policy. And Xi Jinping is particular such case. If we compare our assessment of Xi today with what we wrote about him in 2012, we will be ashamed.
You mentioned the Cultural Revolution, and since we're getting towards the end, I may as well throw in my dotage some of my anecdotes. I was in Beijing at the end of the Cultural Revolution. And apart from meeting Chou Enlai and Jiang Qing, I also briefly met Edgar Allan Snow, who wrote Red Star Over China.
Right, he's still alive.
One of the least quoted quotes from Chairman Mao is still there in Red Star Over China. This was Edgar Allan Snow's first visit since the days in Yan'an. And He said that Mao told him that Formosa, aka Taiwan, should have an act of self-determination at the end of the Second World War.
Right.
Why don't we hear more about this quote? I mean, we hear lots of quotes from Chairman Mao, but this one seems to miss the little red book.
Yes, I heard that quote before, but that was a different time, because at that time, Taiwan was a Japanese colony. It was a prize for Manchu dynasty's loss to the Japanese Empire. And Mao was leading not only a communist revolution, but was from his standpoint, an anti-colonial revolution. So from that standpoint, uniting all the oppressed people around the world, so this is part of the essence of their united front. So it's actually politically convenient for him to appear very enlightened to bless Formosa independence. Now, time has changed. After the Japanese surrender in 1945, China is actually, the state of China is actually a victor state. So, the Cairo Declaration and so on also demanded that Japan return Formosa, Pescadores, and so on back to China. So now China see itself as the successor state to ROC. ROC still exists, much smaller real estate, but ROC still exists. So I think the time has changed, and today they could no longer, I think they probably would prefer that people miss that page in Edgar Snow's book.
Well, I have a copy on the shelf behind me. First edition, in fact.
Right.
So thank you very much. This is Ian Williams with the Foreign Press Association. Our guest has been Vincent Wang from, as you see in the background there, Adelphi University. And thank you for a well-rounded, thoughtful, and dare one say, non-partisan discussion of US, Chinese, and Taiwanese politics. We look forward to seeing you soon. We have impending for our next one, we have actually possible Kosovo as a sort of, since we're scouring the world looking for hotspots, and they're not very hard to find at the moment, I regret to say. So we're hoping to have something on Kosovo, where, as you can see, the trails are fulminating, and consider the implications there. But thank you very much, Vincent. You've done us
proud. Thank you, Ian. The pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, everybody. Please sign up for the Foreign Press Association. Please sign up for our webinars, and send us any ideas for briefings that we should have. Thank you.